Mornings on 2FM.
Thanks to Laura Fox. It's Wednesday, the 7th of June, and this is Game On. What's next for golf as the dust settles on the news that the PGA and LIV will merge? Greg Allen joins us with the latest. While from Jude Bellingham to Lionel Messi, some of the world's biggest footballers are on the move. David Snaith is with us to talk transfers and the Europa Conference League final. Plus, Aoife Murray and Nadine Doherty on Camogie and Ladies Football. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Yeah, welcome along. I'm delighted to say that David Snaith is across from me here in studio. How are you, David?
I'm pretty well. Good evening. How are you?
I'm good, yeah. All is good, I have to say. Lots going on in the world of football. Not sure all of it is good news, but definitely plenty of news. So much, but I'm not exactly sure which is the top story. But I'm going to start with Messi, just because we are talking about, we're going to be talking about Saudi Arabia a little bit later on. Well, he has turned down the offer to go to Saudi Arabia and instead he's going to Inter Miami.
I know, yeah. Just the power of David Beckham.
Well, Phil Neville will even probably put it, send it over the line.
In fairness, Beckham showed his rootless side as well by sacking his mate last weekend.
I know, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like he's sacking Gary though.
I know. Phil always seems to be the one who kind of has a little bit of a punching bag. Although, in fairness, he was quite glowing about him in his speech. So,
the thing about Messi now heading off to Saudi Arabia, it almost feels like he is, or to Inter Miami, it feels like he's nearly a good guy because he's not going to Saudi Arabia.
I know. Yeah, well, even like part of it, if you look at how his whole career at PSG kind of came to an end, like he had the whole suspension thing where he went, ended up going on that kind of unauthorised trip, didn't he, to Saudi Arabia, because obviously he's an ambassador, because it seemed as if everything was like, not so much the stars were aligning, but it almost seemed as if the clouds were descending, and like Lionel Messi, one of the greatest player of all time, was kind of going to the dark side and kind of taking the extra few ball by going to Saudi Arabia and becoming another one of that, the face for that whole. You've seen it now, obviously, this week with the golf and what's happening, and we've seen what's happening with Newcastle, and you see it in various other sports now as well, with boxing and all the rest of that. It just seemed as if Messi, following on from Cristiano Ronaldo, who obviously has gone out there as well, was going to be the next. But yeah, there had been talk about it, that he was going to be going to Inter Miami previously, and then it seemed, obviously, because of his connections with Saudi Arabia and being a tourism ambassador and all the rest, that it was going to go that way. But the fact that he has kind of decided then to go to America and go to the MLS has probably been a bit of a surprise, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah, same. I was nothing surer than I thought he was going to be going to Saudi Arabia, but I guess when you get to his money levels, like,
well,
to
like, at what point is enough? Like, how long? I know obviously he's had his own issues, hasn't he, with kind of what happened to Barcelona and how he exited there and some of the issues that were going on there, but like, surely I can't imagine this decision at this stage with his career should be decided by
what do you think is decided then on lifestyle?
Oh, it could be lifestyle. That's why, isn't it? Apparently, maybe that's the reason why Inter Miami, that deal has gone through, because like, I think he's fond of going to that part of the world quite often and all, going on holidays, and I don't know. Like, it is one of them where you kind of, like, his legacy, let's be honest, because of what's happened with the World Cup as well, like, his legacy now is being assured. This,
yeah, that's a good point, actually.
You know, in that sense, and like, yeah, even before the World Cup, like, I remember writing a piece before the World Cup, as a lot of people would have done, just centered around the fact that it was obviously going to be, it looked as if it was going to be his and Ronaldo's last World Cup. Although Ronaldo is still going on, but I can't imagine he'll get another World Cup out of either of them, to be honest. But kind of making the point that, you know, you had both of them really kind of almost torn in the blind eye, essentially, and being quiet about what was going on. World Cup in Qatar, too, with these, the biggest players in the world who are coming to this stage of a career where they should be like, you know what, they're at a stage now where they have nothing to worry about, you know what I mean? Like, they don't have to be politically correct. They could actually go and maybe be a voice for the disenfranchised if they wanted to, but obviously neither. that's not where they're at, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's why part of this is a little bit surprising, because it did seem as if obviously Messi was set for Saudi, but yeah, like, I don't think even at this stage, like, the football and what he's done for football, that kind of, that's what's going to stand the test of time, really, like, when you think about some of the moments, and even even just thinking back to some of the moments in that World Cup and some of the, even some of what he was doing or his age in that World Cup, because it did seem, it's bizarre when you actually think about it, but like leading up to the World Cup and even at PSG, maybe the fourth season at PSG, and towards, especially towards the end of Barcelona, it did seem as if his whole influence seemed to be waning completely. And his
now level, we can now we can blame Neymar, yeah.
there's always going to be a superstar scapegoat that you can look towards. But it did, that did seem to be the case, that it was kind of maybe dwindling. But then the closer that World Cup came into view, maybe that's what he was almost saving himself
because,
for, you know what
remember
I mean?
We were just analysing how much he was walking around the pitch.
I know
that was like a whole thing for months on end, like that he wasn't running. Maybe he was just saving his energy for the World Cup.
I know, yeah. But it won't be surprised. Yeah. I mean, like, but even in fairness, even in the World Cup, let's be honest, you look at him even in the World Cup, and it was even what Argentina kind of allowed for it. He couldn't have realised, you know what, we're defending with a man less, because just don't. You don't have to get him involved, because you're going to just waste him in that sense. And then you saw him like he's always done, but especially in the last while, like, he just comes alive when he has the ball. So it's going to be interesting, because I think the MLS is actually on TV and over in Ireland it's possible to watch it, isn't it, compared to the Saudi League, so that's actually going to be a benefit.
I'm not 100%
it's going to be a fine way to finish the weekend of sport for a lot of people now, is when the MLS will be on a Sunday night, isn't it?
I think that there might be some global Apple TV deal coming where you can only watch the MLS on Apple TV. I'm not 100%, but I just saw something before I came on air that Apple TV are going to have the global rights, and there's lots of suggestions that Messi being part of the deal made it more attractive for them to acquire the global rights.
Yeah, like the cruel part of me also was thinking, if he had joined Phil Neville's there. Do you remember that great film with Ricky Tomlinson, the Mike Bassett England manager, and he's like he's writing the England team in the back of like a cigarette pack. And it's basically just like Phil Neville just give it to Messi. It's having been some sort of documentary, the Netflix, surely you're saying. That's the big thing we missed out on here, is a possibility of Messi and Phil Neville sharing a screen together.
I don't even know Messi would do a documentary. He doesn't seem like the type, because he never says anything. He barely talks.
Yeah. That's a fair point, actually. But also, and on this, it's a great one, isn't it? In that Class 92 documentary with Manchester United, where Phil Neville breaks down his that when he learned how to do a step over. So even the prospect of Messi and Phil Neville on that pitch, like Phil Neville breaking down how to do like the step over, where he actually steps over the ball to 4 foot.
Do you think he'd call him the gaffer if he was still there? Anyway, moving on. N'Golo Kante does look like, though, he's heading off to Saudi Arabia, and the numbers that are been bandied about for what he's costing is like north of 100 million, which seems absolutely crazy.
I say Chelsea are absolutely rubbing their hands. Todd Bowley is like, here, there's a few more. We've got about five or six more lads that they can take, because obviously Chelsea are going to need to get a few ball being just to comply with financial fair play and see what they're going to be doing. But yeah, we talk about good guys, even with Kante, there's a bit of a sadness with that, but like, even what he's done. But again, it's like, it's similar to what happened. Remember in China, it seems about 10 years ago now. Remember when the Chinese Super League was really taking off and they were signing these type of players? Because even just talking now as well, isn't it? Di Maria is leaving Juventus. He could be gone. So,
and Benzema is gone.
That was confirmed yesterday, wasn't it? Where he's kind of, because like, it's just, I don't think, like, you see the money and the wealth that's involved, and you see, this is the thing as well, maybe it was more so in isolation when the Chinese League was happening, and the Chinese government obviously were the ones who were pumping the money in, and they kind of lost interest after a while. But it does seem as if what's happening now, on a serious point in terms of what's happening now between the kind of the various strands of, to say, the PIF, that fund that's obviously controlling the wealth of Saudi Arabia, like, we're talking about hundreds upon hundreds of billions of dollars here. And it does seem to be that it is part of a kind of a joined up thinking here with different sports, because we've seen it even in the boxing with, say, Anthony Joshua going and having fights in Saudi Arabia. There's like big, obviously, Formula One Grand Prix are going to be going, have already been in that part of the world, and will be going there. Like, they're going to be bidding for this, the World Cup. It looks like we've seen it as well, didn't we, with the Crown Prince who was sitting beside Gio Infantino at the last World Cup, and obviously the World Cup has just been out there in Qatar as well. So, like, there's Newcastle United in the Premier League. There is, and we've seen it again this week with that merger with golf. It's just, it's actually incredible. Like, and obviously, like, I know it's an easy plug, but like, there's a great article that my colleague wrote in the 42, Gavin Cooney, just breaking it down. And I just put up that if you have absolutely no interest in golf and actually don't even like golf, it's the perfect article to read, because it'll just reinforce your opinion of the sport. But also, if you do love golf, it just kind of breaks down just exactly just the craziness of what's gone on here and how it's just been sold, essentially, the whole sport had taken over. And like it does seem as if this isn't just like a flash in the pan where, you know, it's one individual or a certain group of individuals who have just decided we're going to pump a lot of money into football. It does feel as if this could be something prolonged over a long period of time.
And that kind of brings us on then to Manchester United and the fact that Sheikh Jassim Ben Hamad Al Thani has made a fifth bid to buy it and a fifth and final bid for the Qatari banker.
See, this is an interesting one because this almost feels as if this is him maybe preempting the fact that he probably possibly knows that the other bid from Sir Jim Ratcliffe seems to be the preferred one, because that's looks as if maybe that this would be the Qatari saying, well, do you know what? We're going to go with another bid, because they're the ones who are obviously, in terms of both the PR side of things from both parties, where they're the ones who want the 100% buyout. If you talk to some of the, you know, any Manchester United fan who wants the Glazers to be selling the club, they don't want them to be involved in it. But it does seem as if the Ineos and the Jim Ratcliffe bid is them coming in and taking the Glazers share, and then not, but then I'm obviously having a staggered kind of sale of it as well in terms of the deal. So a case of the Glazers will, they'll get their money and they'll get a serious payday and return on what they actually paid for the club, because this is, again, we can talk about sports washing, and we can talk about the fact that clubs, say what's happening now with, say, Saudi Arabia coming into Newcastle United, but the manner of, say, that Manchester United takeover in 2005, where it was allowed to be kind of heavily leveraged debt and all basically put back onto the club, it's just so wrong, you know. Whereas now it does seem to be a case that the Glazers are going to be able to have the debt wiped off for them, which they've just laboured on the club, and basically some of the transfers that people talk about, and they'll always throw it back at Man United fans, oh, well, he spend X, Y and Z, but it's not their money they're spending, it's basically put on a credit card, it's basically labouring, putting debt back on a club that had been debt free before obviously that takeover. And it does seem, in terms of, if you read a lot, especially if you read some of the reporting that's been happening, say, from the likes of the Times of London and stuff, and even say the Athletic have been very kind of good in terms of giving understanding of where it is at, it seems as if the preferred bid, it looks as if it's going to be from Sir Jim Ratcliffe's group. So maybe this could be the Qataris' way of saying, well, do you know what, this is our final way of going out, and we're going to go out on their own terms a little bit, because it's just been, the way it's been carried out, it's just kind of sums up how Man United has been run for the last 10 years. It's just been a complete shambles, and it's been a bit of a disgrace.
But will you go to see them if they're playing the Aviva in the summer?
Oh, because of the no, because actually, it could be actually the weekend of my daughter's christening, so I'm going to be on Father's Day that weekend. And
so you had a story.
I was making this point, like, as well, depending on, like that could be a very, like, there's been a couple of games, yeah. So I've had the story out earlier on where it looks as if it's going to be a friendly, probably the last friendly for United before the season starts in August in the Aviva Stadium. Could be confirmed next week. That's what the talk is. And kind of people who have been talking to about it, but that's what's gonna happen. So probably going to be the tour game. We played Sampdoria back in 2017. They played the League of Ireland 11 back in 2010 when the Aviva had just been reopened after being redeveloped. Doesn't look as if it's going to be a League of Ireland 11 this time. Who they'll be playing? It could be actually another Premier League team. I think I haven't been able to tie down the exacts of specifics of who they will be playing, but that could be an interesting one.
So
as well.
Would a game like that sell out straight away? Yeah.
I'd imagine so. Kids are like, and this is the thing, the fact that it's probably one of the last friendlies as well in the summer, could be new signings in. You don't know who, again, with the situation with the club, who was taken over, who have they spent money. So there could be quite a lot of new signings, or not quite a lot, but there could be two or three new players actually there to play, as well as lads who would have been given a bit of time off. And they've got a tour of America as well in late July too. So, like, I'm guessing the majority, a lot of players will be back, obviously, for that, in terms of giving a fair bit of time off over the summer, you know. Because there was 60 odd games he played last season. With the World Cup thrown in the middle of that season as well. Like, it's incredible. And I know this has gone on a bit of a tangent, but Burnley are already back in pre-season. You know, Premier League doesn't start until 12th of August. That weekend, isn't it? 11th to 12th of August, that weekend. Burnley are already back in. Like, they're back in before, like, the Champions League final. It's crazy.
That's amazing.
It just shows you. It's just relentless.
Yeah, it is. That's, can I say, it's, they're lucky they get paid so much money then.
It does help, yeah.
It does help a little bit anyway, and the fact they get to go for naps in the mid-afternoon, like that kind of stuff. Anyway, I also wanted to talk to you about Jude Bellingham. So there's been so much talk about where he's going to go and how much he's going to go for. 19 years of age, the hottest young player in town, and it looks like it's going to be Real Madrid.
Oh, that broke earlier on today, doesn't it? 100 million, yeah. Like, this is it, not that it's been a saga, it seems as if it's been pointing towards Real Madrid for a fair bit of the...
Liverpool were in the mix for a while.
Yeah, but then I think it was around the start of last month that kind of Klopp pretty much. I think this would have been around the time when clubs, especially in the big transfers, clubs realised, right, this is what could be happening here, which way the wind is blowing, where Klopp came out and said, oh, we're not going to be spending extortionate amounts of money in terms of going for £100 million players. So that would have been around the time, I'd say, where, like, because it was, again, the reports in terms of Bellingham's agents and all the rest of it would have been speaking to different clubs to get a sense, because obviously Liverpool would have been in. They seem to be now going for McAllister, which seems like it could be at Brighton, it could be kind of show you €50 million, because it's mad that that's the ballpark that some clubs are dealing in, and then that's kind of seen as the lower end,
yeah,
almost, you know.
I know. But, well, the Saudi Arabia situation doesn't help things.
I know, yeah. Well, this is it, and this is part of the thing, even with PSG, in terms of the whole how the market was distorted when they obviously bought Neymar and coming in as well. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like that has distorted things, and even with United as well, some of the money that they have squandered and wasted. But the thing with Bellingham, like, such a thing, like, it's one of those points where, again, it's like when he was at Birmingham City and going through, and actually think about it, it was only a few years ago when he was like playing as a 16-year-old in the Championship.
Was it his jersey they retired?
Yeah. This is the thing, they were scoffing about it, but like, his transfer helped save the club. Like, Birmingham is a club that has been in financial dire straits, in terms of one of those typical clubs where you come up to a Premier League having not been in it for a number of years, didn't spend money wisely, there's been takeovers in there in terms of different kind of buyers, and then like his sale helped save the club, essentially. So that's part of the reason, obviously a homegrown player as well, that is part of the reason why he did retire, but people were scoffing at the time. But the ability he had, like, he was very close to going to Manchester United, like, you know, he was one of them where he was in at Carrington when Nolly Solskjaer was the manager and was very close to going there. But obviously at the time, Dortmund, I think Jadon Sancho would have been at Dortmund that season. Haaland was there as well, obviously, where it was seen as, and it has been seen for so long, as a team where you go in and as a teenager, you're going to play North, 30, pretty much every league game.
Like the League of Ireland.
European, yeah. You're going to have...
Did I see Sam Curtis linked with Manchester United today?
I know, in fairness, he was over in a couple of Dutch clubs as well. I think he was over at Feyenoord. He had a bad injury last year as well, like, where... But he's another one, you know. Yeah, Sam Curtis. We've gone from Joe Bellingham to Sam Curtis. Like, and listen, I don't get me wrong, I could talk for about an hour and a half about Sam Curtis if you would like. But that's another player, isn't it? Well, listen, the League of Ireland.
We're talking about the benefits of playing men's football when you're a teenager.
Well, that's it. Like, this is something that we've spoken about on here numerous times, and the whole thing with Brexit and all the rest of it. But it's going to be something now where the development of players who do come in to say first team football, because they're going to have to, that's just going to be the nature now, where lads who are coming through League of Ireland academies, and obviously they get past that stage at 19s, where it goes from, say, 14s up to 19s now, that, right, lads who are at that level are going to be going into first teams very, very quickly. Like, you've seen it, like, it's an incredible one where this year at St. Pat's this week, like, St. Pat's have players in their squad, in their first team squad, doing their junior cert and leaving cert. Like, it's not a novelty as much anymore. Like, even as well, James McManus at Bowles, he started his leaving cert. He's been a regular in squads and getting game time in the first team for Bowles. Like, it doesn't seem anymore as if it's too out of the ordinary for lads who are in the League of Ireland to be doing their leaving cert, whereas now, as it was on Monday, you had Mason Mealy, who obviously was away with Ireland under 17s, doing his junior cert, and he's in training.
That's amazing.
With Pats, you know. Well, obviously for the last little while they were saying that he hasn't actually been in training with the team because he's been allowed to just concentrate on his study. But like, it's even when you have lads like, say, Adam O'Reilly, who was saying that Pats, his teammate who's doing his leaving, like a smashing player, and buffer injury, would have played a lot more games by now as well, because like, he's had a couple of issues with hamstring and stuff, and like, another player coming through, and we've seen it even obviously with Shamrock Rovers, like Gavin Bizzuno, like, he's the poster boy for them as well. But it's just going to be an interesting one now, because like, there's so many like demands that are going to be put on like academies, and the FA are going to have their infrastructure plan that they're announcing tomorrow in terms of financing, and in terms of what they want and what their blueprint and what they want to do going forward for the next number of years, and the development of Irish football. And
is education in there?
It's going to be again at the moment, it's going to be coming out tomorrow. They're going to be doing a big press conference about it tomorrow, and they're going to be going through like in detail about what the, like, education should be.
Yeah.
Like, and literally, I know we've said it before, and like, if you look, for example, now with the current, even in the Ireland squad, and just, it's only come into my mind now, but not to be going off on a past tangent again, but Jamie McGrath, someone who has a degree from Maynooth University, went to St. Pat's, went to Dundalk, over in England, an Ireland international. Like, that's what people would say is the blueprint. But even now with Shamrock Rovers, like, they had an event there for the transition years. Like, Shamrock Rovers have transition year students in, basically, as who are in full-time training as part of their transition year, who are obviously good enough to be in that academy. Like, it's at the stage now where it's happening with Brexit and what has happened with Brexit and what needs to be done for the best young talent, that it's not a case of, oh, clubs need to be having their links with say, a university to make sure they have third level degrees. It's making sure you have the best skills. Like, Rovers have had it for a number of years with a private school in South Dublin, like, where Gavin Bazunu would have went, where a number of their players, a couple of them now who are in their first team, would have went as well in the first team squad. Like, that's what is going to be, it's going to be crucial to it, because, and then on the football side of things, the infrastructure is going to have to be placed, because if you're someone like a Mason Mealy or even any of the young lads who are playing in the 17s, because I can't remember the exact stat, I think it would have been like 17 or 18 of that squad were all home based, rather than years gone by it would have been clubs like back in the day, or Robbie Keane, who would have been around that at Wolves or at Blackburn Rovers, like a Damien Duff, all these type of clubs, like Richie Sadler, who was at Millwall, you know. Now they're here, so what's here for them? Why? How can they actually continue to develop, and how can they continue to get the best standards possible? And it's only going to be through an investment in infrastructure, and there's only so much that the clubs can do. Like, the clubs, it's kind of beating the drum, there's so many talented people and with all the qualifications and the best will in the world and all the best kind of commitment to what to do in it in terms of the development of coaching and giving them this, but when the finance isn't there to back it up, you're doing it with not just one arm behind your back, but two arms behind your back, because all the talent is there in terms of players and in terms of coaching. They just need to be able to have it as their job, rather than being kind of like just volunteering, you know.
Okay, David, we will take a break now. I want to talk about the Conference League final, though, so we might do that a little bit later on. Do stay with us. Greg Allen is standing by to talk all of the golf news very shortly.
Game on.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that Greg Allen is with us in studio. Greg, Rory McIlroy was in front of the media today talking about this PGA Tour Live Golf partnership. How was he? What was his tone like? What was the mood?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think that he wasn't looking forward to this press conference. In fact, he pretty much said as much as that. He was blindsided by this to some degree, although it must be remembered that back in July of last year at the JP McManus Pro-Am, a colleague of mine, Steve Watson from the BBC, interviewed Rory, and Rory said back then, 11 months ago, that the only way this thing is going to be resolved is by having the Live Golf Series, the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour around the table talking about this and trying to resolve it, because there's no point just firing, you know, missiles at each other as they were this time last year, and they have been pretty much through some of 2023 as well. So effectively he was saying get together, but to some degree he was completely excluded from this, and he was also excluded from really knowing too much about it, although he said he was aware of stuff going on in the background. So just to kind of give you the background, there was nobody who has played golf professionally, either at one part of their career or currently now, who was part of this deal. It was Jay Monahan, who is the PGA Tour Commissioner. It was Ed Herlihy, who's chairman of the PGA Tour Board. It was another guy called Jimmy Dunn, a very influential independent director of the on the PGA Tour Board, who's a really good pal of Rory McIlroy's. And it was actually Jimmy Dunn who spoke to McIlroy at 6:30 a.m. yesterday morning, just a few hours before the announcement was made. And he told Rory everything about the deal that went through. And obviously, Yasir Al-Rumayyan, who is the governor of the Public Investment Fund. They were the four people, none of them golfers, no Greg Norman, no Tiger Woods, no Rory McIlroy. All the people who've been locking heads on this weren't involved in the deal that was done. It wasn't done so much behind their back, but it was like it had to be done through back channels because of the presence of Greg Norman, because Greg Norman would have been, I think, a red line for the PGA Tour. They would not do business with him with all the things that he has said over the last 2 years. So that's just the context of it. So how did Rory react? Well, let's just hear, because this is what he said his initial reaction was.
And ultimately, when I try to remove myself from the situation and I look at the bigger picture and I look at 10 years down the line, you know, I think ultimately this is going to be, it's going to be good for the game of professional golf. I think it secures the, it unifies it and it secures its financial future. So, you know, there's mixed emotions in there as well, as there's going to be. I don't understand all the intricacies of what's going on. It's a very there's a lot of ambiguity, there's a lot of things still to be sort of thrashed out, but at least it means that the litigation goes away, which has been a massive burden for everyone, and we can start to work toward, you know, some sort of way of unifying the game at the elite level.
So Greg, last night the players met with Jay Monahan. Seems like there was a lot of criticism towards him.
Yeah, so this was a players meeting at 4 o'clock local time in Canada, so it was 9 o'clock last night, Irish time. So I was monitoring just my social media feed to see what was coming out of it, and straight away what was coming out of it was overwhelmingly negative response. But interestingly, most of the negativity, in fact almost all of the negativity, was coming from players who wouldn't necessarily be star players. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is the fact that some of them would have been offered money, big money, that would have transformed mm-hmm. their lives. They're not the type of players who are, you know, going to turn up and, you know, earn 10 million every year, you know, or vastly more than that. And so a lot of those spoke up. And one of them, Grayson Murray, had an interaction with Rory McIlroy, which wasn't necessarily, you know, friendly, and may have included a few expletives directed towards Rory. So there was, at that meeting, a lot of ill feeling. And a lot of it also was directed towards Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner, who was at the core of these negotiations. And, you know, Rory accepted today that Jay Monahan, who has demonised a great deal of LIV mm-hmm. Golf and the source of the money, and invoked 9/11 in terms of the Saudi Arabian, you know, public investment fund route of LIV Golf. So, you know, the word hypocrite was used, that here's Jay Monahan now going into business with the people that he was demonising. And this is what Rory had to say about that today.
I said it to Jay yesterday, you've galvanised everyone against something, and that thing that you galvanised everyone against, you've now partnered with. It is hypocritical. It sounds hypocritical. The one thing I would say is, again, whether you like it or not, the PIF and the Saudis want to spend money in the game of golf. It is, they want to do this, and they weren't going to stop. So the thing for me, and this is one thing that I've always thought about, how can we get that money into the game but use it the right way? And I think that's what this ultimately will do, hopefully. I mean, that's my hope.
So Greg, then what about all the players who left? Are they just going to come back?
So this is a big bone of contention, is how are they going to you know, bring back the players who left the PGA Tour, took the 100 millions plus, like Dustin Johnson and Cameron Smith, and after barely a year or two out of the, not even 2 years, just a year. Mm. So it was June the 11th, I think, or thereabouts last year that the first LIV event was. So it's almost a year to the day. They're going to be flooding back towards the PGA Tour. Or are they? Or what's the process? Because eventually, if there's going to be a public investment fund of Saudi Arabia, DP World Tour and PGA Tour amalgamation, these players are going to have to be part of the new scene, obviously, because they're all celebrating right now. But Rory isn't too keen that the route back should be a smooth one for them.
There still has to be consequences to actions. You know, the people that left the PGA Tour irreparably harmed this tour, started litigation against it. Like, we can't just welcome them back in. Like, that's not going to happen. And I think that was the one thing that Jay was trying to get across yesterday. Is like, guys, we're not just going to bring these guys back in and pretend like nothing's happened.
That's going to be interesting to see how all that plays out, Greg. Rory did seem quite determined to differentiate between the public investment fund and LIV, though.
So the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia is, you know, is the big bank of Saudi Arabia. You know, the governor is Yasir Al-Rumayyan, his best pal is MBS. So, like, effectively, and his boss is Mohammed bin Salman. So effectively, you know, you have, who's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, sorry. So effectively now, you do have this very, you know, strong differentiation that Rory was keen to make today between what the PIF, the Public Investment Fund, have funded, which is LIV Golf. Mm-hmm. LIV Golf is just the product. The Public Investment Fund is the entity that's now going to be part of this amalgamation. And Rory just wants to see LIV Golf disappear now. After this season's roster, the last of the LIV events will take place during the summer, and that'll be it at the end of 2023. But he was very keen to differentiate the PIF from LIV, and he was very stark about what he thinks still about LIV Golf.
I still hate LIV. Like, I hate LIV. Like, I hope it goes away, and I would fully expect that it does. And I think that's where the distinction here is. This is the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the PIF. very different from LIV. All I've tried to do is protect what the PGA Tour is and what the PGA Tour stands for, and I think it will continue to do that. So, look, going forward, I hope that there's, you know, there may be a team element, and you're going to see maybe me, maybe whoever else play in some sort of team golf, but I don't think it'll look anything like LIV has looked, and I think that's a good thing.
It's a tough day for him, wasn't it, Craig, being out there in front of the media? I know everybody wanted to hear from him. You said he didn't really want to do it. You have interviewed him a million times. Like, how do you think he's actually feeling about it?
Well, I think, you know, he said it himself at one point in the press conference near the end. He said, I just wasn't looking forward to this. And there's a reason for that, because there's a sense that all of this has happened without him knowing, when he has been front and centre defending the PGA Tour against the invader LIV Golf. And I think this was a moment when he dropped his guard, when he said, this is exactly how he felt the PGA Tour had used him in the whole process over the last year or so.
It's hard for me to not sit up here and feel somewhat like a sacrificial lamb, and, you know, feeling like I've put myself out there and this is what happens.
This is what happens. So effectively, business is what's happened. Mm-hmm. It's all come down to billions of dollars. At this point in time, you know, the PIF have invested $2 billion plus in LIV Golf. It really hadn't got the traction that they were looking for. They had a terrible television deal that nobody was really watching. Mm-hmm. They had an online presence on YouTube. They had their own website, but they didn't have the big TV deal. They had the massive amounts of money going to players, $4 million for the winner of a LIV event, 14 events this year. So what were they getting back? It didn't really matter to some degree, because they had so much money that the PIF, it's not a business. The PIF is an actual fund. They just keep going deep into their fund until they get what they want. An indication that maybe what they wanted wasn't what they were getting, mm-hmm. in terms of the whole sport washing thing wasn't really washing very well. They were only drawing attention, more attention to the other side of the darker side of the human rights, whatever you want to call it, scenario in Saudi Arabia, which, you know, is basically how the world was still viewing LIV Golf and the Public Investment Fund. So they weren't gaining anything really from the last year of LIV Golf, other than establishing a very strong bulwark to absolutely be there as omnipresent beside the PGA Tour, luring their players away and draining them away, and also critically, the litigation, the court cases, we're going to run into tens of millions of dollars of wasted dollars, and maybe even into, who knows, $100 million by the time, if it kept lingering on. And they were going to be kicked down the road for 2 years. They lost the case to the DP World Tour in the arbitration in February. A week after that was announced, and it was announced in early April at the Masters, a week later, they had a very serious setback in their case against the PGA Tour, where the judge said, this is probably not going to come to court for 2 years. So suddenly they were now in a situation where let's do business. And it's very interesting that the timescale of all of this was middle of April until now. And what happened? Those two court cases went against LIV, and it looks as though they approached the PGA Tour and said, okay, let's do business. And business is what's been done here. It's all about money.
Okay, Greg, on that very unpleasant note, we're going to take a very quick break. Thank you so much for coming in. Do stay with us, though. Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray up next.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to ladies football. We're going to hear from Nadine Doherty in just a minute. But first of all, I want to give a shout out, David Snaid. I have to give a shout out to Clare under 14 ladies football team, who are playing in the All-Ireland final against Wicklow on Saturday in Nenagh. So best of luck to them. I'm showing my bias here now. The producer is not happy at all. Now we're going to turn our attention to ladies football. And it was announced a couple of days ago that Davy Nelson, the Meath manager, stepped down from his role after just 8 months in charge. A little bit earlier, I caught up with Nadine Doherty, and I started by asking her if she was surprised by this Meath news.
By the timing of it, Marie, to be honest. You know, in terms of Jay, especially, obviously in soccer we see it happen a lot, but in terms of Jay, it's very rare for a manager to step away mid-season. It's not a surprise considering the results, I suppose, as you said, in the current form of the teams, the Meath ladies. But you know, we saw it already this year. It happened in Donegal with the men's team. Paddy Carr stepped away a few weeks before the Ulster Championship, and it seemed like players themselves played a part in his departure. in this case, you know, I'd be a bit surprised if conversations with an alternative management team perhaps haven't already been taking place informally, because, listen, as we said, it is rare for a whole management team to step away mid-season without an alternative. But look, in terms of Nelson himself, you know, the short time he was there in the spotlight, he always seemed to be a very positive guy, and he was very honest in interviews, Marie. You know, he wasn't afraid to highlight where things have gone wrong this year, but he seemed to always try and put a positive spin on, I suppose, how Meath could make it right. But I just feel with him, time really has run out. But look, in terms of the exact reasons, we might find out in the next week or two, but you just look at the results. Listen, one win from seven in the league and one win out of three in Leinster, it's probably not good enough, really, you know, considering they're coming off the back of two All-Irelands. And the players' energy from Emery and the pitch, we spoke about that all the time this year. You know, they tried to continue with that game plan and that system, but Meath just don't have the same energy. And I suppose we know as well from being involved in teams, the energy of a team says a lot about maybe what's happening off the pitch. And there was a bit of negative body language, and you have a lot of high profile players just not playing well. So there are obviously reasons behind that, and we don't know why, but the Meath ladies do. And look, tactically as well, when you look at him, you know, he admitted freely at the start of the season, and I think rightly so, that he wasn't going to go in and try and make huge changes to a system mm-hmm. that was working. But, you know, defensively, they remained very good. But we've spoken about it a lot. They just aren't scoring enough, Marie, and it's not working. So look, yeah, we'll see where it goes. There aren't any rumours flying around, but I really wouldn't be surprised if Eamon Murray and Mark Brennan makes a return with him. Mark Brennan obviously stepped away with Davy Nelson, but it really wouldn't surprise me if Eamon Murray made a comeback, to be honest, for the next few weeks.
Well, wouldn't that be some story if he did come back and they managed to get things moving in the right direction again all the way to the end of the summer?
Yeah, and listen, he had a magic touch with them for those few years, Murray. I mean, when he took them, what was that, 5-6 years ago? They were at absolute rock bottom. They're fairly low at the minute. And look, he's a very, very good relationship with those players. He does bring an excellent backroom team. Now, obviously, he doesn't have Eugene Ivers and Paul Garrigan available. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a huge loss for me, Murray, even more so than Eamon as manager. I just think that coaching team, their departure was a massive loss. And even if Eamon does come back, I think he's going to have to bring very, very, very strong coaches with him to get the team back to where they are, because the clock is against them at this stage. You know, they're out on the 25th of June against Waterford, and they face a resurgent Donegal the following week. So if he is to come back in, he'll have to have serious coaches with him, I feel.
And even just in terms of the game plan and trying to consistently play like that year after year and give the amount of output as well, Nadine, because they were playing, I guess, pretty much to full capacity for two seasons when they won those All-Irelands. How difficult is it to keep up that level all the time?
I think when you're winning, Marie, and I think when there's a good bond between the team, and I think when the coaching is of a really high standard and players are happy, I think it's quite easy, to be honest. You know, when people are feeling good, they're playing good. When things aren't going well, and perhaps there is a bit of unrest, it's extremely difficult. And that's what we've seen with me this season. When that cohesion isn't there from the training pitch to the playing pitch, it's a very, very hard game plan, because you have to be willing to work not just for yourself but for your team and for your management team. And I think that's why that previous management team were such a key, because the players really, really wanted to work for them. And if we are to read between the lines of what has happened on the pitch this year, they just don't seem to have that energy, and I feel it's because they weren't happy with how things perhaps were going on the training pitch. You know, they're a young team, Marie, and even though it is high energy, it's high press, when you want to play at that level, you play. It just comes automatically to you. You know, that's what I feel about them, because they are young, you know, and extremely talented. But just that body language, as we spoke about there, it's just negative, and it's not working for them.
And I guess as well, when you look at the championship groups, like, there's no easy group at all, and it's going to be difficult for anyone to come out of it. You mentioned their group there with Donegal and Waterford. The top two in each group qualify for the quarterfinals. So I guess, Nadine, if they felt it wasn't working and they only had that little bit of time and they want to go for three in a row, then trying to get out of that group is going to be crucial.
Oh, 100%. And I'd say that was a massive factor in whatever discussions happened. They're looking at that group. It's very doable for them. But I think they would have felt that they need changes because, you know, you look at Donegal resurgence. I'm not saying Donegal are favourites for an All-Ireland. I'm not even saying that they're in the running. But they did make a very, very big statement and things are turning for them at the right time and in the positive direction. And Waterford, Marie, we have spoken about them throughout the year. They're capable of bringing it on the day against any team and they do seem to peak very well come championship. So me, they're definitely looking at that. And they were thinking, listen, we have 3-4 weeks to go here. What is happening isn't working for us. So we need to make a change. And listen, we'll see who comes in. Will they have enough time? I'm not sure. But the groups are so competitive, Marie, as you said. You know, they really are. And interestingly, with it this year, you know, before this, we saw that the quarterfinal draws were preempted. You know, you could, it would have been, let's say, the winners of Group 1 against the runners-up in Group 3. It's an open draw now. So your top teams are in an open draw against your second-place team. So Meath, I feel they will feel they can get a bounce off this if they get the person that they want.
Let's have a look at some of these groups. We will go into them in more detail, maybe in, closer to the time. But Group 1, Mayo, Armagh, Laois. Group 2, as we mentioned, Donegal, Meath, Waterford. Group 3, Dublin, Kerry, Cavan. And Group 4, Cork, Galway, Tipperary. You'd imagine there's going to be an upset or two along the way here. Which group do you think it's going to come from, Nadine?
I think the Cork, Galway, Tipperary overall is probably the most competitive, Marie. I mean, Cork, like Donegal, they've just really, really hit full tilt in the provincial. They look very good against Kerry. You have a Galway team who we haven't seen since that league final, and I suppose the provincial lost to Mayo as well. I think we could fairly be questioning where they're at, but I mean, Galway are a serious team, a serious outfit on paper. So you'd think that the breakaway from the pitch has probably done them the world of good. And Tipperary had a very competitive Munster, Marie. It just all depends with Tipperary, I suppose, when their players are going to the AFLW. If they're going to be around for the All-Ireland Series, they could produce a shock in that group. You know, you're looking at Cavan, I suppose, and Laois in Group 3 and Group 1, who haven't performed very well at all this year. You know, I know Laois did get to that Division 2 league final, but they really looked out of their depth in Leinster. Mm-hmm. So you'd figure Armagh, if Amy Mackin is fit, you'd figure Armagh and Mayo should go through that group, and Dublin and Kerry in Group 3. But again, I mean, look at Kerry flying high during the league. They've had a very, very disappointing Munster campaign, and no more than Galway, I think a lot of soul searching will have to be done there and has been done over the last couple of weeks. But again, that Group 2, Donegal, Meath, Waterford, Group 2 and Group 4, I think, could be where the shocks might happen. But who knows, Marie, I always get these things wrong. So hopefully you nobody will quote me. I said it exactly.
I just wanted to talk to you about one other thing as well, Nadine. So Conor Myler, who we all know has been a Tyrone footballer, he's also doing his PhD on the topic of integration of Gaelic games. So obviously that integration piece has been worked on at the moment between the GAA Camogie Association and the LGFA, and today he outlined 5 recommendations that he believes should be implemented as part of that merger. He's working with Dr. Katie Liston of Ulster University and Aoife Lane of TUS, and some of the things that he feels need to be recommended are the plan for the process, so to plan it all out, to have guiding principles and values, to prioritise female representation like Golf Ireland did when they were integrating, and to have a funding model. So he, and the final one then, is to build a new organisation. So they seem to be working away behind the scenes, Nadine, and doing what they need to do to try and edge this closer. Did you get a chance to have a look at anything that Conor had pointed out today?
Yeah, I heard in the radio this morning and I read through the article earlier. I mean, I think it's brilliant, Marie, and I think any research is always so helpful and extremely important in any context. But I think for the steering group as well, to have, I suppose, these recommendations as an extension of the starting point that they already have, I think it's brilliant. And for me, the fact that a lot of his research is centred on equality, I think that's so important from a female perspective. And, you know, he quoted that what he's seen from research in the past is that females can be marginalised through an integration or a merger. So the fact that he's identified that and highlighted that already, it's brilliant. And if that was to happen in this context, Marie, you know, then it would completely defeat the purpose of why this whole process started. I mean, we have to think back that this integration process started because of the inequalities that exist between our female and male GA players. So it's brilliant. And I think another important thing is that, you know, there's an acknowledgement of time and how much time it could and should take to ensure the process is a success. And I mean, we've been on the show, you know, every time it comes up, we're almost impatient. And I think we do have to reflect on this and agree with his research in that in order for this to happen and to happen in the right manner, that we will have to be patient with it. And Aoife Lane also highlighted, which I thought was a really important piece, of acknowledging both the fears and the opportunities around integration and that they both carry equal weight. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very important and just interesting in that, because sometimes the fears, I suppose, they dominate and they take over. And when they're paired together, a fear almost brings about an opportunity in a sense. So the fact that they're looking at that closely as well is brilliant. And I just think in general, Marie, you know, education is massive here, and the more research and guidance available to the committee, I think it'll impact on the success overall. I think it's brilliant, really, really positive.
And he also pointed out as well that they're going to talk to the grassroots, to the clubs, and find out what their fears and, as you said, the opportunities are around what they're thinking about integration, because I think that's where it's going to be really difficult, just from being in a club and looking around and seeing the barriers that are put up in front of women.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is where it started, mm-hmm. starts and it should start. And I think that's where the steering group have started their conversations as well. And, you know, they also acknowledge that we're building a new organisation here. And I suppose the thought and even the mention of a new organisation might scare a massive cohort of the GA membership. And I just think that, you know, any significant change can be daunting to some, but it is going to take a new organisation, and it'll be for the better of society as a whole. And I think with this research, the fact that it really, really puts it out there explicitly, Marie, and I think it'll be worth a read for all of us. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited to see the full piece. But yeah, listen, the grassroots, that's really where everything begins, Marie, and it's the most important, I think, for the longevity of anything. So the fact that they've identified that explicitly as well is really positive.
Okay, Nadine, thank you so much for all of that. Enjoy next weekend, and we will talk to you next week.
Super, Marie. Chat
soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, that was Nadine Doherty. I spoke to her a little bit earlier on. I'm delighted to say now that Aoife Murray joins us on the line. How are you, Aoife?
Really good. How are you?
Yeah, great. Sure. It's great to have the championship up and going, isn't it?
That's it. And clear top of Group 1 as well, Marie. That's what we want. I'm sure that made you smile.
Not so sure if the Cork Camogie fans were smiling after the weekend, though. Disappointing loss to Galway, Aoife?
I suppose, to be honest, I can't even probably explain the result more so. Not disappointed with the result, sorry. I'm more so disappointed with the performance behind the result. I think that's probably what the most worrying thing about Saturday afternoon was. And I know we kind of laughed and joked about it being a transition period. And in many ways, it's an easy excuse, isn't it? Even thinking back on even myself using that term. And I know yourself, myself and Nadine had a bit of a laugh on it. But maybe it was an actual excuse when you look at the performance on Saturday afternoon. And that's probably the biggest worry and fear and probably disappointment that I had with the result. Not so much losing, but it was the manner in which you went about not being able to close out that game.
Yeah, that was that one I watched as well, Aoife. It was the second half in particular, the fact that they didn't seem to be able to find a way to get the scores. And they do have good forwards there.
Yeah, but and in fairness, even the way they set up, right, they had a very isolated full forward. Like Galway dropped, was it Hannity? I can't exactly remember. Dropped back right on the D. And we were really on top in the first half by our running game. Like, Hannah Looney cut through numerous times, so did Keating, and we were really causing them a lot of trouble. So then all of a sudden we isolated Mackey in full, Amy for a time. Galway dropped a person back on the D, and then we hit long ball in. Like, that was the bit that I couldn't really grasp, because we were normally quite good at managing the game and making sure we put it right down into that melting pot last 5 minutes and making, you know, good decisions in really hard moments. And it seems quite lackluster, and I hate saying this, the leadership, because mm-hmm. there's plenty of times I played games and you know you'd read afterwards and you'd hear people like myself going, there was no leadership. I'm sure there was, but it just didn't come across in how they went about it, because let's face it, Galway didn't perform to the level that they could have performed, and that I think for me is the most worrying thing, is Galway were probably at 65% of their capabilities, right? Cork, we had all the possession and we weren't able to put away an underperforming Galway team. You could flip it and go, fair play to Galway, massive credit that they were still able to find a way to win the game. But from a Cork perspective, I would worry about some of the basics in the game. And one particular area where you can't really train, which is the fight, is the aggression, the physicality. We were blown off the ball a number of times, and that's probably one thing. I watched the game with Jim O'Connor, and both of us, that's the one thing I think we kind of were both saying, was the physicality side of it, that we always seem to come out second. So it was worrying. I hope that we've time in 2 weeks to put that right, but we've certainly put ourselves under pressure.
Okay, Aoife Murray, thank you for all of that. We'll get into the Camogie in a little bit more detail next week, because we are nearly out of time. David Snaid, before we do finish up, any team news from the West Ham Fiorentina game?
I think the same is pretty standard as what you would expect. I think Bowen, Antonio, Bernardo up front. Paquette is playing midfield with Souček, and Declan Rice, captain. Could be holding a European trophy aloft later on this evening. I'm sure there's a lot of Ireland fans behind them. But Soufal, Zouma, Aguerd and Emerson with Arriola in goal for their game against Fiorentina, kicks off in about just over an hour.
Okay, well, plenty of time for you to get home now and watch Declan Rice lift that trophy. That is all we have time for this evening. I'll be back tomorrow. Beto Da Silva's up next. RTE 2FM.